You know, I was driving over a suspension bridge the other day, just stuck in traffic, staring at those massive steel cables, and I had this thought. We tend to think of steel as this, well, as this dead thing.
Red.
Yeah, like a static block of matter, you know. It's cold, it's hard, it's unchanging. You buy a steel beam, you put it in a building, and it just sits there. But then I started reading the material for today's deep dive, and I realized I couldn't be more wrong.
You really couldn't. If you could shrink yourself down to the atomic level and look inside that cable, you wouldn't see a static block. You would see a battlefield.
A battlefield.
Absolute chaos. It is a dynamic landscape where crystals are fighting for territory, atoms are frantically rearranging themselves, and decisions are being made in fractions of a second that determine whether that bridge holds up or snaps in half.
It's basically Game of Thrones at a microscopic level.
It really is. And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We aren't just talking about metal. We are talking about the secret decision-making process of crystals. We're doing a deep dive into a PhD thesis from 2011 by Kim Dae-woo out of Pohang University of Science and Technology.
And we should mention, this work was supervised by Professor HKDH Padatia, who I've learned is basically a titan in the field of metallurgy.
A rock star, absolutely.
Now, the thesis has a title that sounds a bit like a spell from Harry Potter. Variant selection of allotriomorphic ferrite in steels.
It's a mouthful.
It is. But stick with us, because this is basically a detective story. We are investigating a mystery about how steel decides which way to point its crystals. Because apparently, it's not random. There is a hidden logic, a set of rules involving neighbors, energy, and even geometry.
Exactly. And for a long time, the assumption was that this specific type of transformation, the birth of this allotriomorphic ferrite, was, somewhat random, or at least too messy to predict easily. Kim's work says, no, there was a logic here.
So let's meet the protagonist of our story. This character called allotriomorphic ferrite. I looked up the etymology here because I love a good Greek root. Allo means other, and morph means form.
Right. Other form.
So does that imply it's a shapeshifter? Or is it having some kind of identity crisis?
In a way, it's a shapeshifter. The term implies that the phase, the new crystal growing inside the steel, does not respect its own internal crystalline symmetry. It doesn't get to choose its own shape.
Okay, let's unpack that. Usually crystals have a shape they want to be, right?
Exactly. Like how salt wants to be a cube or a snowflake wants to be hexagonal. But allotriomorphic ferrite is the squatter of the steel world.
The squat.
That's the best way to think about it. It forms at the grain boundaries of the parent phase, which is called austenite. Imagine the austenite as a honeycomb of existing grains. This ferrite nucleates. It is born right in the cracks between those grains.
So it's squeezed in the gaps.
Precisely. And because it nucleates there, it just grows into whatever space is available. It fills the gaps. It grows into the shape of the space rather than growing into a beautiful geometric cube or needle that it might want to be.
It's opportunistic. It just flows like a puddle into the container it finds.
And this happens at high temperatures just below the AE3 temperature.
Which is significant. Why?
Because it's the first thing to pop up as the steel cools. It's
Yeah.
the first transformation product. And because it's first, it dictates everything that happens
The
afterwards.
first mover advantage.
The huge advantage, as it grows, it rejects carbon. It pushes carbon out into the remaining austenite, essentially changing the chemistry of the battlefield for everyone else who shows up later.
So it sets the stage. But here is the puzzle that the thesis highlights. There are two main ways steel transforms, right? The military way and the civilian way.
That is one way to put it. You have displacive transformations like martensite or bainite. That is the military shift. Atoms move in a coordinated, disciplined fashion. Click, click, click.
And because it's a coordinated military movement, I assume there's a lot of.
Huge strain energy. The lattice literally shears. And because of that strain, external stress can easily dictate which way the crystals align. That's variant selection in the military style. It's very predictable because the force dictates the direction.
But our guy, the squatter allotriomorphic ferrite, that's the civilian method.
Right. This is a reconstructive transformation. The atoms aren't marching, they are diffusing, they are mixing up, wandering around, and settling into new positions. There is no massive shape deformation, no huge strain energy to guide them.
So if there's no drill sergeant ordering them around and no massive strain pushing them in one direction,
Yeah.
why aren't they just pointing in random directions? Why isn't it just chaos?
That is the core mystery. Since there is no shape deformation to guide it, you would expect a random texture. But the source material shows clearly they are not random. They are choosing a specific orientation.
Which means there is a hidden set of rules they are following.
Exactly. And this brings us to the first filter in this decision-making process, the one good neighbor rule.
Okay, wait on me.
It all comes down to energy. Nature hates high energy, it wants to be lazy. When a new grain of ferrite is born at the boundary between two old austenite grains, it has to create an interface, a wall between itself and its neighbors.
And walls cost energy.
Interfacial energy. The standard theory, and this was popularized by researchers like Lee and Aronson, is that the new ferrite crystal will try to minimize this cost. It does that by aligning perfectly with one of its neighbors.
So it snuggles up to the neighbor on the left, matches its pattern, and creates a nice, smooth, low-energy wall.
We call that a faceted interface. It's neat, tidy, and low energy, but usually it can't match both neighbors. The neighbor on the right is at a weird angle, so the interface with the second neighbor is just a mess. It's a random curved boundary.
So it picks a favorite. It turns its back on one neighbor to have a perfect relationship with the other.
That's the classical view. You pick the orientation that gives you the best fit with one side. This lowers the activation energy required to be born. It's just easier to nucleate if you fit in well with someone.
But Kim's thesis takes this a step further. He asks a really difficult question. Is it possible to please everyone?
And this is where it gets fascinating, the dual orientation hypothesis. Kim proposes that under certain special conditions, the ferrite doesn't just match one neighbor. It manages to find an orientation that matches both adjacent austenite grains simultaneously.
That sounds incredibly difficult. I mean, imagine two people standing next to each other facing different directions. Trying to stand in a way that aligns with both of them seems almost impossible.
In a random crowd, it is impossible, or, statistically very unlikely.
Yeah.
But Kim found that the structure of the austenite, the parent grains, isn't always random.
This is the coincidence site lattice, or CSL boundaries, right? I saw that in the notes.
Yes, CSL boundaries. These are special boundaries where the two austenite grains already share a lot of lattice points. They have a geometric relationship.
So the neighbors are already kind of related. They're cousins.
Exactly. And because the neighbors have this special CSL relationship, it opens up a geometric loophole, a sweet spot where a ferrite grain can nucleate and achieve a low-energy coherent fit with both sides at once.
A double lock.
A double lock. And the thesis identifies this as a new type of simultaneous matching. When ferrite forms at these specific boundaries, the probability of this dual orientation jumps significantly.
So the steel isn't just rolling the dice. It's looking for these specific geometric sweet spots, these CSL boundaries, and preferentially growing crystals that lock into those spots.
It's a huge aha moment. It explains why we see textures that the one good neighbor rule just couldn't predict. The crystal is optimizing for the local environment much more aggressively than we thought.
Okay, so that's birth. That's nucleation.
Yeah.
You've managed to be born by finding a good spot between neighbors, but now you have to survive.
Survival of the fittest, or in this case, survival of the fastest.
This leads us to the next big chunk of the thesis, growth selection. Because it's not enough to just exist, you have to grow to take up space. And space inside that steel block is limited.
Completely limited. We call this hard impingement.
Which is a fancy scientific way of saying bumping into things.
Yes. As these grains grow, they eventually hit each other. And once they hit, they stop growing in that direction. But here is the catch. They don't all grow at the same speed.
Why not? If they're all ferrite, shouldn't they grow the same?
You would think so, but remember where they are growing into. They are eating up the austenite. And the austenite grains are not all created equal.
This is the stored energy concept.
Right. This thesis focuses a lot on deformed steel that has been rolled or squished. When you deform the austenite, some grains get more beat up than others. They store more energy.
Like a compressed spring versus a relaxed spring.
Exactly. High stored energy. Now, thermodynamics dictates that the system wants to release that energy. Ferrite, growing into a high-energy austenite grain, is actually doing the system a favor. It's replacing a stressed-out grain with a relaxed one.
So the system rewards that growth.
It accelerates it. The ferrite zooms into the high-energy grains, but it grows sluggishly into the low-energy grains.
So imagine you are a ferrite crystal. You might have the perfect orientation. You might have nailed the dual orientation we talked about. But if you are surrounded by low-energy, boring austenite grains.
You get boxed in. The ferrite grains next door, the ones eating the high-energy lunch, will grow huge and cut you off. You stay tiny. And here is the kicker. In the final analysis of the steel texture, tiny grains don't count for much.
History is written by the victors.
In this case, texture is determined by the growers. Kim developed a model to predict this. He showed that you can't just look at who is born, the nucleation. You have to look at who wins the race, the growth. The final texture intensity is heavily skewed by this growth selection.
It's a two-stage filter. First, can you find a low-energy spot to be born? Second, is there enough stored energy, enough food around you to let you grow big?
Perfectly put. And identifying that second filter explains why computer models based solely on nucleation were always a little bit off. They were missing the competitive eating contest happening during growth.
Speaking of computer models, we should talk about how Kim actually did this work. Because looking at this stuff isn't easy. You can't just, you know, squint at a piece of metal.
No, this is heavy computational metallurgy. He used EBSD electron backscatter diffraction to map the actual orientations, but he also built a virtual world.
The Kelvin tetrahedra.
I love that word.
It sounds like a dinosaur.
Yeah,
or a spell.
It's a beautiful geometric shape, a 14-sided solid. Lord Kelvin proposed it as the most efficient way to pack 3D space with equal-sized objects.
It looks like a Dungeons & Dragons die.
It does. He used these shapes to model the austenite grains in the computer, creating a virtual block of steel where he could assign specific orientations to every single face of those 14-sided grains.
That allows him to test these theories about neighbors. He can virtually say, okay, grain A is here, grain B is here, what happens at the boundary?
Exactly. And he took it a step further into the realm of AI. The thesis discusses using artificial neural networks.
And remember, this is 2011. This isn't the AI boom of the 2020s where everyone has a chatbot.
Yeah.
This was cutting edge.
It was. He used neural networks to predict the texture of interstitial free, or IF, steels. He fed the neural net inputs like chemical composition, how much the steel was cold rolled, the reduction percentage, and the annealing temperature.
And the goal was to see if the AI could predict the final orientation without doing all the complex physics calculations.
Or to bridge the gap where the physics was just too complex. And the result was successful. The AI could predict the development of texture, matching published data. It validated that if you know the starting ingredients and the processing conditions, the variant selection isn't random, it's predictable.
So let's zoom out. We've talked about squatters, competitive eating, and 14-sided dice. But what does this all mean for the listener? Why should you care about whether a crystal is pointing north, northwest, or northwest?
It comes down to performance, specifically toughness.
We tend to think of steel as just strong, but toughness is different.
Very different. Strength is how much load you can take. Toughness is how much energy you can absorb before you snap. We care about cracks.
Cracks are the enemy.
When a crack starts in a piece of metal, it wants to travel. If the crystals are all aligned in a way that gives the crack an easy path like tearing a piece of paper along the grain, the steel fails catastrophically.
You want the crack to have a hard time. You want it to get lost.
You want to force the crack to twist and turn. And this is where the distinction between metallographic grain size and crystallographic grain size becomes crucial.
Unpack that distinction for us.
Metallographic grain size is just what you see under a light microscope. Oh, there's a boundary. But if the grain on the other side of that boundary is oriented almost exactly the same way,
the crack doesn't care. It just sails right through.
Exactly. To a crack, that boundary doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. That is the crystallographic grain size. If we can control variant selection, if we can force the steel to choose orientations that are misaligned with each other, we effectively make the crystallographic grain size smaller.
And that makes the steel tougher.
Much tougher. Without changing the chemistry, just by controlling the starting lineup of the austenite and the heat treatment, we can determine the winner of that atomic competition and get a safer, stronger material.
That is the big takeaway. We used to think of heat treatment, of cooking metal, as just heating it up and cooling it down, like baking a cake.
But it's not a cake. It's a competitive sport occurring at the atomic level.
Crystals fighting for space, exploiting geometric loopholes like those CSL boundaries, and feeding on stored energy.
And Kim's thesis gives us the playbook for that sport. It tells us that if we understand the rules of the game, the neighbor matching, the energy consumption, we can rig the game. We can predetermine the winner to get exactly the properties we need.
It really changes how you look at a car frame or a building beam. It's not just a chunk of metal. It's a frozen snapshot of a massive, violent, complex struggle for dominance.
And beautiful order arising from that struggle.
Absolutely. So here's a final thought for you to mull over. We talked about how the ferrite chooses its structure based on the stored energy of the austenite, the stress memory of the metal.
Yes.
It makes you wonder, if we could map that stored energy perfectly in 3D before the transformation starts, could we essentially 3D print the internal structure of steel just by how we squish it before we cool it? Could we write information into the crystal structure itself?
That is a provocative thought. Controlling the path of information, or in this case, load, by programming the deformation history, it's certainly where this kind of research could lead.
We're programming matter at the atomic level. Something to think about next time you drive over a bridge.
Thanks for diving deep with us today into the secret life of crystals.
Always a pleasure.
See you next time.